Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is your true calling? A young British man discovered his in an unlikely place in the 1940s as headmaster of a Chinese school catering mostly to war orphans. But George Hogg did more than educate his 60-odd pupils. When Japanese troops began their advance westward in 1945, Hogg packed up the school and its impoverished students and led them to safety, traveling 700 miles with nothing more than mule carts of hastily packed possessions for much of the trip. The amazing story forms the basis for a new feature film called The Children of Wangxi. Jonathan Rhys-Meyers plays George Hogg with Michelle Yeoh, Chow Yun-fat, and Radha Mitchell in major roles. The film opens later this month, and we are pleased to have director Roger Spotswood with us to talk about it. Roger, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
How did a nice, middle-class Englishman like George Hogg get himself tied up in this conflict between China and Japan?
He came from a very enterprising family. They were pacifists, they were thinkers, and at least one of them, his aunt, was an explorer. And when he was 27, I think, she was heading off to America and then to Japan, and then she was thinking about where to go next. And she took him with her, or he went with her, and crossed America. And while she went by the regular train, he decided to interview hobos and rode the rails, as they called it then, with the hobos. And he crossed America on the rails and wrote a number of interviews. He was a learning journalist. He wanted to be a journalist. So he was writing, sending articles back to the Guardian. And he went on to Japan. He learned some Japanese. And then she didn't go to China, but he did. He was 25, 26, and wanted to explore the world, and was very enterprising. And the world was going to war, and he wanted to, you know, learn more about the East. And he did that first in Japan, but while there, knew nothing about really what was happening in China because the Japanese weren't talking about it. And then got to China and discovered not only was there a civil war, but the Japanese had invaded a year earlier and terrible things were going on.
Soon after the film opens, he finds himself witnessing something that I think for most people would change their lives. And it sort of sets him on a path that he could not have anticipated.
Yeah, it's the story of a young optimist who thinks he's going to be a war journalist and he's going to have this heroic, interesting life and it's all going to be romantic and fascinating. And then he's in Nanjing during the massacre and witnesses just a small part of it and realizes that it's a much more serious, terrifying world that he's in. And then circumstances lead him to the school or orphanage, and he finds himself doing something quite different than what he'd expected. And according to the people he saves, some of whom are still alive, he really was a sort of extraordinary educator and hero, and a sort of quiet hero, and that's what attracted me to him. He was somebody who didn't pick up a gun during a war. He didn't try and shoot his way out of anything. He found himself looking after some kids and keeping them alive and changing their lives, even though he lost his life. And it was a very interesting story.
What I really liked about the film was that although that is apparent about his character, he struggles at one point in the film with the fact that despite his pacifist background and his belief in particular virtues, there's one point at which when someone he cares about is threatened that he actually wants there to be violence. And it's something that really sort of strikes him as hard to believe about himself.
Well, I think everyone is full of contradictions. Mm-hmm. And this was a contradiction that we had in the story, and people kept saying, "Well, you should take that out because he's one thing or the other." Mm-hmm. But in fact, it's the kind of complication that makes people interesting. And yes, he starts off saying, shoot him," even though he's really a pacifist at heart. And later on, when the same person says, "I'm going to go and shoot those two people because they're Japanese," and they'll go back and they'll say where we are, and Hogg protects them and can't bring himself to kill them and tries to keep them alive.
You shot this film entirely on location. You were in the mountains and in the desert and everything else. I read one account that you were in the Gobi Desert and even with modern equipment and trucks and everything had a hard time getting around.
Well, indeed, the first day of shooting, we were out in one of the most remote places. And it was a three-hour journey from the hotel. Many times in China, if you want beautiful places, they're nowhere near the hotels. And we'd been there many, many times, But on our first day of shooting, we hadn't been there for 2 weeks, and we did not know that the road was going to be torn up. The last 10 miles of the road were gone. The last 10 miles before the location itself. And there was just a little coffee can, Chinese coffee can or tea can, some sort of can in the road with a piece of cardboard. And we saw it in our headlights, and it was an arrow written by arrow. You could hardly see it. And this was 5 in the morning. And the whole convoy of 50 trucks stopped, and trucks carrying trucks and also equipment and buses and crew. And we had several hundred people in the crew. And we headed off into the desert. But we were on the edge of the soft Gobi, between the hard Gobi and the soft Gobi. And it literally is like that. In the hard Gobi, nothing grows. It looks like the moon. And the desert is pretty, you can drive a truck on it.
It's compact. Yeah.
And in the soft Gobi, it looks like it's compact. And it has those extraordinary dunes that you see in the film. But it's a crust, and if you go through it. So we had to head off into it with some trepidation. And sure enough, in a few hundred yards, all of the vehicles just sank down to their axles. Terrifying moment.
Because you're financially responsible for this whole thing,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah, the first day of shooting. And it looks like we'll never get out of here. And then I really learned a little bit about China, because I got out with my AD, Jerry, the only other Englishman, and it was pitch black except for the moon, a little moonlight, and the trucks were all grinding away and digging themselves in deeper, and he said, we're screwed. We have to try and see if there are any stones, any rocks, anything. And so we went out in the darkness and started picking up little stones, and thinking, well, we'll see if we can take them back and put them under our vehicle. And then looked around, and in the darkness, you could see all these other forms. Everyone in the crew was doing it. Everyone. And there were it was a very big crew. And 2 hours, 3 hours later, 400 people had put enough stones under the wheels of the vehicles and dug them out enough that we slowly drove out and got away with it. And it's this idea, there was no coffee, it was freezing, it was below zero, everyone just without a word, without being asked, nobody was organized. The vast Chinese crew knows that when things go wrong, this huge manpower changes things. And they just got out and they made a road. And that was kind of how it works in China. It's extraordinary. They're very good technicians. They know what they're doing. They know how to make films. But when things get difficult, it's the application of lots of people and an uncomplaining knowledge that this is the only way it will happen.
Roger Spotswood is my guest. He's the director of a new film called The Children of Wangxi. The thing that's really amazing about that story is that I would think that if that happened in the U.S. or in Europe, you'd have a lot of people sitting around saying, not my job.
Not my job. No, exactly. It would have been completely different. And where's the coffee? And how did this happen?
My back hurts.
Where's craft service? This is day one. If it's going to be organized like this, we'll never make the film. We're not being fed. What happened? Why didn't you guys check it out? Well, of course, we had checked it out. But there would be just complaints, and nobody. It would be nobody's job. It was everybody's job to fix it. Mm-hmm. And they did. And that was kind of there's a scene at the end of the film, a crane pulled back from a grave. And when we looked at that before shooting, when we were at that location, another very remote place, Zhao Jiading, the DP who'd done Hero and House of Flying Daggers, a wonderful, wonderful cinematographer, didn't speak really any English, but then I didn't speak any Chinese. We had a translator for the entire crew, for the entire crew. Anyway, Zhao Jiading says, this really is a crane shot, you know. And I said, yeah, but Shading, you know, there's absolutely nowhere to put a crane. And we are a very long way from that road down there. You can't get a crane here. He said, no. The shot's good, right? We'll get it. Of course we'll get a crane here. And I sort of laughed. Okay. Knowing full well that you could not get a crane there. And on the day, of course, 100 or more people pick up this. They assemble a crane down at the bottom, and they carry it up a ludicrously steep path that nobody in their minds would even think of carrying a very heavy crane up. without a word, without a murmur, it's up there ready for the shot. It's, you couldn't get a grip crew to, you know. They would say, well, you get a helicopter and get something or have a road built or do something, but not in China.
Is it stressful when you're working with a Chinese crew and mostly Chinese actors? I know that the children were all Chinese nationals, right? Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you can never fully relax because you can't? There are things you're not that are going on that you're not fully understanding around you.
Yeah, you have to accept there's going to be a lot of reinvention. There's going to be things that are lost in translation. What a terrific mm-hmm. film and terrific title that is. But there are also things that are born in being lost, and you know, things come out of that. You can't micromanage something like this. But in deciding to do this, it was partly because we didn't have money to bring in a crew, but also because I thought this is a story about a man who went to China and became Chinese and worked with them and bought nothing from the West except his spirit. So maybe if we do it in that spirit, if we go there and use an entirely Chinese crew and translate as well as we can and show them what I'm trying to make and let them make it in a Chinese way, maybe it'll end up being more interesting and more truthful than if I tell them exactly what to do. I can try, but I also have to accept that they will interpret it. And some will get lost in the translation, but maybe something will be gained in the mistranslation. It'll become more Chinese than it would have. So maybe that was a very interesting experiment, and I think in some ways it worked out, at least to my happiness, that I thought it did become more Chinese than I expected.
Did Jonathan Rhys-Meyers speak any Chinese before he started the project?
No. He learned it in rather, and it's not easy, but they learned the lines, they learned the
sort
scenes.
Of phonetically to say the lines. That it's got to be hard to act in a language you don't understand.
Oh, it's really difficult.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if Chow Yun-fat, who sort of did the opposite in English and now speaks English fully, mm-hmm. If he was able to offer any perspective on that and if you saw them sort of working together in that way.
He let Johnny learn. He didn't try and teach him the language, but he encouraged him and kept him going. And he has a very nice humor and irony about that. He came to the opening in China about 4 weeks ago. We were in the little town of Huangshi and we had a meal on the last day. We sat around a big circular table of 15 people or so. And many dishes came along, and there was this new dish of sort of whitish meat in a clearish sauce, and people looked at it and sort of sniffed it and the Westerners and said, well, what is that? And he said, Yun-fat said, oh, it's chow. And of course, we immediately thought, is he using his own name, or does he mean chow, or is it a chow that, what exactly? And somebody said, yeah, but not the dog. He went, mm-hmm. Oh, my God, this is terrible. And then they said, well, no, I was just kidding. Maybe. Everyone was left in complete confusion.
Did you take a bite?
I didn't. I have a thought. I'm afraid. I am.
Director Roger Spotswood is my guest. His new film is called The Children of Huangshi. We will return to our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director Roger Spotswood. His new film, which opens later this month, is called The Children of Wangxi. It tells the story of George Hogg, who led dozens of war orphans from China about 700 miles to safety to escape the advance of Japanese troops in 1945. If you'd like to join the conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. As a parent of just two children, I know how hard it can be to motivate them to do anything. And there's a scene in there where the decision has been made that they've got to go from where they are. And he's got these teenagers and he's got, you know, much younger boys that he's got to get up and get going. And I was struck by the challenge it would be just to get them going and to convince them. But these are children in this film and in the true story who didn't need to be convinced of how dangerous it was in a war.
Yeah, they had all seen and witnessed terrible things, so they were much easier to motivate. It was still a huge distance and an amazing challenge, and actually in the end titles you see one of them talking about he still remembers the session in front of the blackboard with Hogg explaining how far they had to go and why they had to go and so forth, and how what an impossible journey it was. But they were very motivated kids, and in fact, the kids I got today to play them were equally, in a way, motivated. They were very, very enthusiastic. And I mean, they loved having 4 months away from school, even though we brought teachers with us. But they were a very enthusiastic and joyful crowd of kids. And they came through a very long winter with us.
The film is really beautiful throughout, but there's one, I think the most arresting shot was of one little boy when they've just been told they have to leave, and he sort of sighs and rolls his eyes, and you can see him sort of steeling himself for what's about to happen, and it was just brilliant, and I wonder how much of that was sort of natural from the kids, and how much of that you had to sort of work with them and explain what they were supposed to be communicating.
That particular kid was Ching, in fact, and I had found him a year earlier in a long, long casting session, and he's not a theater kid. He's not going to be an actor, but he is enormously gifted and terribly nice, and he was so inside it. It was like a real actor. I mean, he was inside his character. He knew it. He didn't talk about it. He didn't want to talk about it. He just said, let me do it. And then you tell me if I got something wrong. I mean, through translators. Mm-hmm. And he had it all figured out. He thought about what this person would have thought about back then. And he didn't act it. He just was it. And
so he's like Stanislavski.
Yeah, he was pretty surprising.
You know, people always say it's so challenging to work with children. Is it somehow easier when you have to use a translator because everyone already knows it's kind of an artificial setup? I'm wondering how that went when you had to say it to someone else and they said it to the kid and you don't know if they're saying exactly what you wanted.
I think it's both. In that situation, there were many kids and a lot of them were around and they were with us on the set all the time. And they took their lessons sort of next door in the next room or just behind us or somewhere. So they were very much part of our group. So they learned about filmmaking without thinking about it. And they became actors in a funny way. And we did tell them things, but they also understood a lot as it went along. They're partly from their Chinese crew, but they understood the story and they understood the world they were in. And they sort of got it. And they didn't need a lot of explaining. They behaved very naturally, and let's assume by the time we'd put them in their clothes and fed them terrible food, because there was only terrible food, and once they'd reminded us it was terrible, they also knew that they were starving and that I'd only cast very, very thin kids. And they kind of got it very easily. So the translation was just a small part of it. They understood a lot of it from the situation, from where we shot in very beautiful but very old places, and they got a sense of what the film really was.
I do love at the end that you have actual interviews with the boys now who are in their 70s and 80s, I guess. And I'm wondering at what point in the process you actually had the opportunity to interview them. Was it after you'd already finished filming, or was it before you set out?
It was more and more, a little bit before, and then during, and then afterwards at the end. They were wary of us at first, and they wanted us to really honor Hogg. And But the further we got along in the pre-production, the more they knew about us and the more we started meeting them and seeing bits of them. And then they would send messages and give us notes and so forth. So it was a process.
Were there things that they told you that you wished you had known?
There were things I've seen and that I know now from, yes, that I'm tempted. I would have loved to have put in. On the other hand, it's such a complex and long story that it really, the script was a process of condensation, of simplification. There's only so much you can put into 2 hours. So I couldn't have fitted very much more in, I don't think.
Yeah, that has to be a struggle because, and you've done several films that are based on actual stories. And I think it happens in almost every sort of narrative film made out of a true story. There are things that there are details that are sort of changed to fit the film. Was it something though that you struggled with that you thought, oh gosh, I wonder if this is going to change things too much, or did you feel like that's the only way you can get a film out?
Oh, there were parts of the story. He was there longer than I would have loved to have had. But we just could not figure a way to make the film convincingly within 2 hours that way. While this film was being prepared, we lost our money for a while. One element of the money dropped out. It took us 9 months to get it back. And in that time, I was asked to make a film in Rwanda about a real person. Shake hands with the devil. The General Dallaire, who was the on-the-ground UN commander during the genocide. And his story really took place 4 months before the genocide and then for the 100 days of the genocide. So it was like 200 days or 250 days. This is not 3 years of somebody's life or 1 year of life. It's a very, very contained period. But even that was an enormous struggle to try and to simplify and bring down to, and we did, to two hours, 2.25 hours. But it's very hard to take complicated stories of lives and to be truthful to them and make them be cohesive and coherent.
I know that making a film involves so much more than just being engrossed in the story, but you had, you know, two really intensive projects, I guess, sort of overlapping each other about genocide. Did it start to affect your worldview? And did you, I mean...
Yeah, I kept thinking, what's wrong with you? You're making two films about genocide. So the Japanese one of 15 million, you know. But actually, Shake Hands with the Devil is very much a few people's journey through a real genocide, but it's also a story about the UN and what we all did and didn't do. And Children of Guangxi is very much about what one person can do in an extraordinary situation. It's different. It's not a genocide film. It's a story about hope and enthusiasm and an amazing journey that this guy took and with the children. So, yes, I felt strange at times, but the details of each one were very different, and they were two really remarkable people, and I adored both of them. One I would never meet, and the other one I met many times. And it was a fascinating few years.
There's still so much denial from Japan about the real numbers and the amount of people who were harmed and who were killed during that time. Do you know whether the film will be screened there?
Not at the moment, no. They haven't bought it yet, so we don't. I think it'll be difficult. At some point it will be. When I did a film in Japan a long time ago, 10 years ago, and at that time, this was a film about Hiroshima, the older people would not talk about what happened in China. The younger ones were eager that it come out. They knew what had happened, and they said, why should we have this huge thing? It was a terrible thing. We shouldn't have done it. And we should apologize to the Chinese and move on. The parents wouldn't do that. And the younger people, at least in our crew and the ones we met, felt it was time for them to move on. It was time to be honest about it, to recognize it, and to make things right. And they were much closer to Germany. It was the older ones. And one just hopes that as time goes by, you know, those younger ones will assert themselves and Japan will finally be able to face what it did and move into the future and have a relationship with China.
Do you think that's a matter of the older generation somehow still identifying with what happened and feeling guilt that they don't want to revisit?
I wish it was that. I don't think it is.
You think they don't feel responsible?
I don't think they feel responsible. I don't think they even recognize that they did anything wrong. I think that's a racist generation that believes that they're superior and that what they did in China was just one of those things.
The other pattern to the two genocide films is that in both cases you have sort of a white European kind of coming in to people and being the savior of sorts to people of color. Have you faced any criticism of that? Do people say, well, this is one way of looking at it and they're true stories, but this is a worldview that doesn't necessarily reflect what happens in a general sense?
The particular stories happen to be true. And we don't really say that this is a universal, that all white people saved it. So, yeah, one could complain that this story is out of balance. But, of course, individual stories are only about what really happened in that situation. And they did both happen. Hogg is remembered very, very fondly by all the Chinese who met him, were still alive, and who were very, very eager that we make a film about him to show what this man had done. So they felt this was a very good thing that an Englishman be, or a European, a Westerner, be given the praise that they felt he should have. And for Dallaire is the first person in the Rwanda story to say that it was the Ghanaians and the other officers who were with him who were extraordinarily brave. I think Dallaire is extraordinary too, but he will tell you and everyone inside that it was the Ghanaians and the other troops who saved the 30,000 people there. And he felt responsible for not saving more. The Rwandan government and the Rwandans that you meet, on the other hand, are the first people to tell you that Dallaire is the only white person they met who was honest and tried and did everything he could to save them. And they were all in favor of making the film about it. They didn't say, well, this was about a white racist. They say, no, they don't complain that it was a white man, a racist point of view to make a story about a white person. They said, we open your doors if you're telling the story of Dallaire, the person who stayed here and tried to help us. We open our doors to you. You can shoot any way you want. I've never been in a country where everyone let us shoot where we wanted to shoot. Nobody would pay a penny in bribes or graft or anything to anyone. Everyone does that to get in on sets, on difficult things. You overpay to get into places, and we do it all the time. We didn't do that at all in Rwanda. We didn't have to. We were welcome, not for us, but because what the film was about.
Filmmaker Roger Spotswood is my guest. His newest release, which will come out later this month, is called The Children of Wang Shi. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. How well known is George Hogg in China?
Oh, not very well known. I mean, a few people.
So it's still an obscure story.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I know the world premiere took place there. Can you talk about that and sort of what the response was?
It seemed to be a very good response. The premiere was actually in the little town of Wangxi, after which the film has become named, and it was very Chinese. I think they instead of having a premiere screening, they had a press screening in the morning, but they had an event. But it was very effective. They had a media event. It was on national television, and then excerpts played for the next week. They put on a two-hour sort of pop concert, and during it, Chow Yun-fat came and was interviewed for 20 minutes, and there were these pop singers, and then the two hosts would come on. And throughout the whole event, commercials played for the film. They made trailers, and they had trailers for their town. The town of
for the tourist industry, right?
Well, sort of, yeah. But Huangshi is a little mining town and of 2 million people and a vast amount of pollution. And they mine gold and copper and lead there. And it's one of hundreds of little cities that is very impoverished. And they somehow want to be better known. And the mayor wants to be better known and to move up in the party, I think. And so putting on an event for us and getting Huangshi well known, the town of Huangshi well known, was worth them staging this huge event. 25,000 people showed up, 1,500 troops to make sure that everyone behaved properly, and the singers and the event, and they made the commercials, and their commercials, which showed iron mills and pits.
So they weren't trying to show that it looked better than it actually did?
Well, they did. They were very beautiful steel mills. I mean, you know, they were shot in a pretty way. They're not very beautiful, but
billowing, you know, black smoke.
Yeah. They made it look as good as possible, but they made it about this is the thriving industry of this part of China, and you know, this is a growth town. This was encouraging investment and encouraging promotion of the people who were there. So it was interesting. It was an infomercial for them and for us.
Mm-hmm. Obviously you've been to China many times before, but were there things that you didn't fully appreciate about Chinese culture until you did this project specifically?
I didn't really understand the huge gap in the language. You cannot translate many things directly because the culture and the language are so different from ours that it's translation is quite difficult. You have to give an idea of what you're doing, but quite often it'll come out differently. And you have to work out a system where that works. That was one part of it.
Is it hard when you can't share humor? Because sometimes when things get tense, if everyone speaks the same language, you can make a joke and everyone kind of titters.
Yeah. No, that is much harder. When an event happens that is funny and everyone laughs, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. But then other times it's more difficult. We found one day we were shooting and I realized there was a huge boom shadow, the shadow of the boom.
The microphone overhead.
Yeah. And it was on the actor's face and the camera was pointing right at it and it was just sitting there. And I said, you know, this really doesn't work. We can't do this. The sun is there. Huh? And he laughed. The boom man laughed, and I said, "What's good?" And it turned out that laughter is embarrassment.
Oh.
And so the part of humor was quite complicated to deal with because sometimes their humor was embarrassment and doing things wrong and covering, and other times it was the same as our humor.
So you had to learn to interpret when you were getting which kind
mean,
of laughter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Roger Spotswood is my guest. He's a director whose new film is called The Children of Wangxi. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director Roger Spotswood. His new film is called The Children of Wangxi. It opens later this month. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Your father produced a handful of documentaries. Is that right, before you were born?
Yeah.
Was that sort of part of your family legacy? Did he maintain an interest in film while you were growing up?
Yes, he was making them right through to the time he died in 71. So, yeah, that was very much part of his life. And I was born in Canada because he was the most junior part of a little group that was sent to Canada to make North American films in 1940. Churchill had this idea that the only thing that would save Europe was getting America into the war. And he didn't know that the Japanese were going to help out with Pearl Harbor.
Could have saved himself a lot of filmmaking dollars.
Yes. So he sent this group off to Ottawa, in fact, and they set up shop there, and they made films in Canada and in North America. And it became the National Film Board, but that was later on. And so he was there, and he was making films, and then he went on making documentaries when he came back.
So later on, he did things that were to his specific interest as opposed to sort of made to order?
No, he made, he did a lot of corporate. They were interesting subjects. Yeah. In those days, you could get documentaries made only by oil companies. Shell had a huge film unit, mm-hmm. and they made actually rather interesting films about foreign places before. Well, while television was just starting to explore that, The big oil companies spent lots of money at public in PR, but they did it with film units. And so he would go all over the world. He'd do Song of Ceylon and various other films that were interesting and told the country. Features used to open with a documentary sometimes, so they had wider distribution. So it was an interesting.
So was he always delighted at your career choice?
No.
He didn't die a rich man.
No, that wasn't. He was only from European cinema, and I mean, he liked European films. He thought documentaries were the main thing, and so he didn't really. I started in commercials. I didn't get on with him very well, and so I did the opposite. So I started as an assistant in commercials, which he didn't terribly approve of, and then I went and worked for Peckinpah. Mm-hmm. And so to him, this was Hollywood, and then he died shortly after that. So I was going in the wrong direction from his point of view.
It seems like what you're doing now, though, would probably please him.
It probably would, yes.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is director Roger Spotswood. Let's speak to Mary Ellen in Dallas. Hi, Mary Ellen.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I'm curious to know if this gentleman's movie, Children of Boanxi, is based on the same story as The End of the Sixth Happiness that told about this young British woman who was a missionary, and she, one of their converts led 100 children from Yangcheng to Xi'an, and then she led another 100 that same distance during the same Japanese period.
The answer is no, and it's not based on the same story, but it is the case that this happened, three or four times. So I think both of them are based on real incidents, but different incidents. And I met a woman who was the prototype of one of the characters in our story that Radha Mitchell plays, and she must have been very much like the woman in The End of the Sixth Happiness. She was not a missionary, but she was something of an adventuress who had gone to China in the early 30s, with an English education, but not no particular specialty, and had found herself in the middle of a civil war and become a nurse and just started helping wounded people in a field hospital and become a nurse and later on become actually a field surgeon. So, and she told me when I met her in the 60s that there were 30 or 40 women that she knew of who'd been in China at that time who had ended up looking after children, looking after hospitals. They'd self-trained. None of these were professional doctors, but they became so, and they became remarkably accomplished. And in an interesting way, they became outsiders because they found they couldn't go back to their country of origin because it wouldn't be interesting because all the skills they'd learned in the middle of a war, they couldn't apply. They had no professional paperwork. But they had these vast skills and experience. And so they tended to stay on in China. Many of them stayed there and died there.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. The email address is think@kera.org. Jessica in Dallas writes, I'm an American girl of European heritage who's fallen in love with Chinese culture. When I was there, I was quite surprised to find that there's still a great degree of anti-Japanese sentiment, and that may be an understatement. In making a film like this, what was your experience with this, and do you think that the film will play any role in this long-seated grudge?
I think there is a great depth of feeling, and there will be so. If I don't know when you were there, but if it was 2 or 3 years ago, that was at the time when the new textbooks were issued in parts of Japan. In the rural part of Japan that described the Japanese invasion of China as some sort of cultural experiment whereby they went to help the Chinese.
They were completely sanitized of all the killing.
Completely sanitized. So there was a particular amount of outrage in China at the time. And I think until the Japanese come to terms with the past, it is going to come up that they have avoided this part of their history. So even though things may be temporarily getting better at the moment, somebody from China is there and talking, I don't think it's ever going to get better until the Japanese come to terms. And I don't think our film will make any difference, but four films are being made about Nanjing. And hopefully the more people write about it or talk about it, the Japanese will come to understand that they should talk about it. They should understand what happened in the same way the Germans did. And the Germans have come to terms with what they did, and they've apologized, and they've talked about it, and it's been many years. And there's been an acceptance that everyone can move forward from that. And I don't think things will get better in between China and Japan until the same process happens. And until the Japanese admit what happened, it will be very hard to move really substantially forward.
You said earlier that the Children of Guangxi is very much about the difference that one person can make in the lives of other people. I would imagine, as a filmmaker, conflict between people is something that you're constantly having to think about and imagine and sort of interpret. Do you think there's a difference between conflicts that occur between one society and another, one large group of people and another, and individuals? Can one extrapolate to the other?
I don't. It's a question one asks oneself a lot, but I really don't know whether it all comes down to the kernel of how do we treat each other. I think to some extent it does. It comes down to thinking about how is the other person feeling instead of just putting them into a capsule and saying that's an enemy who's done something I can't stand and they're bad people and I've got to deal with them. You have to acknowledge that the other person may have a point of view, may not be all a bad person, may even have many things you share, and then you can start understanding each other and find resolution. So I think there are elements between the individual and the group that are similar.
It definitely sounds like this was not the easiest film that you've ever made. You talked about, you know, at one point in the middle, the funding dropped out. And I would imagine you could have gone and done another Bond film or another something very commercial. What caused you to stick with this when you could have just handed it off to someone?
It was fascinating. Mm-hmm. I mean, both of I did these two films in 3 years, the Rwanda film and this film, and they were both absolutely fascinating. Partly because I love the subjects. Each of them were about remarkable people. But also because of the way we made the film in both countries, differently, but each way was interesting. In Rwanda, we had half a Rwandan crew. We took Canadians, but we had a lot of Rwandans who really hadn't made films before, and that was fascinating. They were terrific, and we taught them. And in China, we took a Chinese crew who knew exactly how to make films, so one was plunging into another world and watching them make your film, my film, in a different way and trying to sort of slightly steer the boat but also allow enough freedom that they could be contributing. So it was a very interesting process, and I found there's no other film I could have made that I could have thought of that would have been more interesting to me anyway, to find out another country's culture and work experience through doing it with them. And having them add to a story that is also about the same thing. It's about how an Englishman went there and became sort of half Chinese and did things that were very important for the Chinese. My film isn't going to be important, but it was an interesting process for me to learn to work with them and have a huge language barrier and to work within that and enjoy it and be hugely frustrated at times, but also to know that even in the frustrations there would be gifts, there would be rewards, there would be discoveries.
Your career, you've done such varied kinds of projects. I mean, we mentioned the Bond film, you've done adventure things, you've done these very serious films, you did Turner and Hooch. Have you sort of deliberately made sure that you touched on every genre?
No, but you sort of find if you're making films like The Band Played On or Hiroshima or Noriega, those films, which are very interesting to make, that you also have to finance the next one. You have to find ways to develop them and so forth. And you can't really make a life. It's hard to do, though. They take a long time to get made. And the other world of films where studios pay you to go out and make the films can be fun and different, and they pay for the other one. So there's a sort of, I found a balance between the two. And there's the films I've tried to make that have been more mine, like The Spire and Noriega and Hiroshima and the band, they all need, they take time, they need money, they need investment. You have to keep them going. This one, Children of Guangxi, I worked on for 8 years to get to the screen. So the other film supported.
Does it feel like a sacrifice to have to, in order to get a film like And the Band Played On, does it feel like a sacrifice to have to do something that, that is a good piece of work but isn't what you dreamed of doing?
No, well, it's not. There are times when I wish I didn't have to, but there are other times when I went off with Tom Hanks. I had actually a very good time with the dog. And I enjoyed making the Bond film, and Air America was kind of both. It was a studio film, but it was also about an interesting subject. So I found ways of, that the films that I've done for to pay the bills and to support the other ones. Mainly, I've been lucky. I did a film with Sidney Poitier. I've done films that I found interesting and with interesting people, and so it hasn't been a terrible sacrifice. It's worked out pretty well.
We had Bill T. Jones, the choreographer, on the show a couple of months ago, and I was talking to him about when he's choreographer, does he think about his dancers as sort of objects to be moved exactly as he wants them to, or does he think about them as artists in their own right? Because the interpretation either falls with the dancer or it falls with the choreographer. It's not that way with a director, I would imagine. Even if you wanted to, you can't make actors into automatons, can you?
I'm told.
Have you tried?
No. I haven't. I have no interest in it. But I'm told there are people who tell them exactly what to do and where to be and what. I don't know that. I mean, I haven't done it. For me, what's interesting is the sort of reverse of control. It's letting go. It's trying to find a canvas and saying this is kind of the limits of the canvas and these are kind of the colors we're using and this is what it is, and now here's some freedom to add to it. When I first came here, actually to Texas, it was with Peckinpah, and he would shoot millions of feet, and he would come into the cutting room, and he'd look at your film, and he'd say, "No, it's not right." And you'd say, "Well, do you want to lengthen the shot?" He said, "Well, I'm not going to tell you what to do. If I have to, I get your assistant to do that. I can always have the film the way I want it. I want you to add something. I'm telling you, you're not there yet, and come up with something else." Come up with more. Can I make it more interesting? Or think about somebody else in the scene. He would give you sort of clues, but he would never, ever say what to do. And then he sort of encourage you a little bit. Sometimes he'd curse you, and he'd say, just be, play with it. But he'd never say what. He'd never say, and I found that a wonderful lesson, that people give of their best if you encourage them and ask them to contribute. You have to pick the right people, but you bring people in who will surprise you.
Do you think he was deliberately mentoring you, or he just wanted his film the way he wanted it?
Maybe both, but I think he really believed that. He would goad people, he'd attack them, he'd laugh at them, he'd do all sorts of things to make you do something, because he really believed in it.
Roger Spotswood's new film will open later this month. It's called The Children of Wang Shi. Roger, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Joel, thank you. Thanks so much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.